Today's episode of Court Junkie is sponsored by the Netflix original series Mindhunter, starring Jonathan Groff and Holt McCallany. How do we get ahead of crazy if we don't know how crazy thinks? Two FBI agents set out on a sinister investigative odyssey, probing the depths of the killer's minds to discover the brutal answers and comprehend the motivations of killing. Mindhunter, October 13th, only on Netflix. It was September 11th, 2017, and the family of Holly Bobo was in court at the Hardin County Courthouse in Savannah, Tennessee, hoping to finally get answers as to what happened to their 20-year-old daughter. Holly had gone missing from her home near Parsons, Tennessee, on the morning of April 13, 2011. She was a nursing student at the University of Tennessee at Martin and had a big test that morning. When she didn't show up at 9 a.m., when the test was scheduled to begin, the teacher found that was so out of character for her that she postponed the test for the entire class for a few minutes, thinking that Holly would walk in at any minute, that she was just running behind. But Holly never showed, and so her classmates took the test without her. After Holly's mother called the police to report her missing, officers showed up at the Bobo home, and just outside the back door, near where Holly's car was still in the carport, were about 50 to 60 drops of blood, blood that would later be tested and determined to be Holly's. Holly's brother, 25-year-old Clint Bobo, told investigators that he had seen Holly earlier that morning from the back window, walking into the woods behind their house with a man wearing camouflage. He had assumed that man was her boyfriend, Drew, but he would come to find out that it wasn't. A massive search overtook Decatur County and the surrounding areas. Multiple law enforcement agents and volunteer searchers took to the streets, canvassing the neighborhoods, knocking on doors, searching abandoned sheds and homes. But it was almost as if Holly had vanished into thin air. Within the next few days and weeks, some of Holly's personal belongings were discovered nearby, as though they had been carelessly strewn about. And then, in September 2014, more than 3 years later, a horrific discovery by two ginseng hunters in northern Decatur County, about 20 miles from her home. Holly's remains, or what was left of them, were found. But for years, Holly's family was in the dark as to what had happened to her, and everyone who had been following the case hoped that this trial, set to start in September 2017, would finally reveal some answers. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie Episode 37. And today, I'm covering the Holly Bobo case. In 2014, before Holly's remains were found, arrests were finally made in the case. Three men, 29-year-old Zach Adams, his younger brother, 26-year-old Dylan Adams, and 39-year-old Jason Autry, were all ultimately arrested and charged with rape, kidnapping, and murder. According to an affidavit from the Tennessee Bureau of Investigations, or TBI, Dylan Adams told investigators that he had seen Holly at his brother Zach's residence the morning of her disappearance. He also admitted to being involved in the forcible rape of Holly and said that Zach told him that he had raped Holly and had videotaped it, although no such video has ever been found. A fourth man, 30-year-old Shane Austin, was granted immunity in the case in exchange for his cooperation in leading authorities to Holly's body. Shane was the cousin of Jason Autry and was reportedly friends with Zach and Dylan, and police believed that he had also taken part in whatever happened to Holly. But just months later, prosecutors revoked that immunity agreement with Shane, saying that he hadn't been truthful with them and was unwilling to help investigators find her body. Shane's lawyer then sued them for breach of contract. But in February 2015, the immunity dispute abruptly ended. Shane's body was found in a hotel room in Bartow, Florida. One of their main suspects in Holly's murder had committed suicide by hanging. With three suspects left, Zach Adams, his brother Dylan Adams, and Jason Autry, prosecutors decided to make a deal with Jason in January 2017. Jason agreed to plead guilty to kidnapping and murder in exchange for his testimony against Zach at his trial. Zach's trial started on September 11th, 2017, and if convicted, he would be facing the death penalty. The stakes were high. Would we finally learn what happened to Holly Bobo, or would we be left with more questions than answers? In his opening statements, prosecutor Paul Hagerman said that Zach Adams took her, raped her, killed her, discarded her, covered it up, bragged about it, and almost got away with it. He said Zach's life consisted of meth, morphine, and all the, quote, dark, dark things that went along with it. He said that on the morning of April 13th, 2011, Holly sent a text to her boyfriend at 7:42 a.m., and then minutes later, she walked out of the back door of her home to her car to leave for school. And that's when it happened. A neighbor heard a scream and a call for help. Clint woke up, heard voices, looked out the window, and saw a man in camouflage walking Holly into the woods. And there she goes forever, Hagerman said. Gone. 3.5 years later, Holly's skull, teeth, and some of her ribs were found in the woods, off an interstate just 4 or 5 miles from Zach's house. Hagerman said those 3.5 years didn't go by quickly. Law enforcement checked the local sex offenders and even concentrated heavily on one man, a man named Terry Britt, who lived in the same area. They ripped into Terry's life, Hagerman said. They talked to all of his friends, his family, his wife, and searched his house over and over. They followed him, tapped his phones and his house, but found absolutely nothing. But then police talked to Zach and his friends, Jason Autry and Shane Austin. They heard that they had said some things about Holly. They looked into their alibis and discovered they were lies. Hagerman highlighted what Jason is expected to testify about, the details of what he saw the day that Holly was killed. Hagerman said that after years of searching and false leads, going into dark places and talking to dark people, they now know what happened. Yet the world will never know exactly what happened to Holly because they had years to destroy evidence, to get rid of crime scenes, and to build lies on lies. He said Zach had a 3.5 year head start. You can understand why he was so confident that he would never get caught, he said. There's no DNA and no fingerprints. And for years, the police were looking at the wrong person. Zach thought he had gotten away with it. Hagerman repeated his line from the beginning of his opening statement, saying, he took her, he raped her, he killed her, he discarded her, he covered it up, he bragged about it, and he almost got away with it. But he didn't, he said, because we're here now. In their opening statements, Zach's defense attorney, Jennifer Thompson, asked, so how is it that we got here today? She said Zach did not murder, kidnap, abduct, or rape Holly. In fact, he didn't even know Holly and had never laid eyes on her. Thompson called Holly a good person and said that this is a case that has captured everyone's attention. She said, quote, she was an all-American girl, a good student, good daughter, had a boyfriend she loved, was working very hard to be a nurse, shy, quiet, kind to others, loved her family, her country, and the Lord, was a good person. This is a tragedy where she was a good person and something bad happened to her. However, Zach is not guilty of this crime. Thompson said that police were at the Bobo home within 15 minutes of being called, and after that initial few hours, officers had interviewed nearly every person in Decatur County, many people twice. There were thousands and thousands of phone calls from across the country and even international calls. Numerous psychics called in. For years, police worked to solve the crime, and they had many suspects. Thompson rattled off a list of people who had been scrutinized in the investigation, people whose phone records were gone through, whose houses and phones had been wiretapped. She said they suspected a man named James Barnes at one point, who lived next door and who had heard Holly screaming that morning, and a man named John Dodd, the grandson of some people who lived down the road. Someone said they saw him and his pickup truck in the area that morning, and Terry Britt. She said police even looked at Clint Bobo, Holly's brother. At some point, the Bobos retained an attorney to represent Clint. They went through his phone records and often treated the Bobo family as though they were involved. She said that this was the most expensive and most exhaustive investigation in the history of the state of Tennessee, and yet in 2013, they had nothing to show for it, and everyone wanted answers. Jason Autry, Zach Adams, and Shane Austin's names came up. A friend of theirs told the Bobo family's private investigator, Dennis Benjamin, who was also working with police, that he had heard that Zach Adams had used Jason Autry as an alibi for that day. He told him to look at Zach's brother Dylan, who has a low IQ, and to talk to him. At some point, police charged Dylan with a series of federal drug crimes and burglary. The assistant prosecutor in the case was also working on Holly's case. Dylan was facing 120 months in prison when the most amazing thing happens, Thompson said. Dylan pleaded guilty to lesser charges and was released with no jail time. But one of the conditions of his release was that he had to go live with Dennis Benjamin, the private investigator who was working with the Bobo family and with police. She said 5 weeks later, Benjamin called 911 and said that he had someone at his house who wanted to confess to Holly's murder. They brought Dylan in and videotaped it. And based on that confession, they charged Jason, Dylan, and Zach. Thompson told the jury that the problem is that a lot of what Dylan confessed to doesn't match the evidence. And, she said, police got extensive warrants to search Zach's property, and they took over 500 items from his house. But no DNA, no fingerprints, and no hair connected him to Holly. She said the state had this confession from a special ed kid that didn't match the evidence, so they needed something else. So they bought Jason's testimony, telling him that he won't face the death penalty if he testifies against Zach. Jason's story is different than Dylan's, she said. Jason had access to the discovery in the case for several years, and he didn't come forward with his story until January of 2017. She told the jury to pay attention to the cell phone records because they will show that Jason and Zach were together that morning near the Tennessee River, which doesn't jive with them having taken Holly from her home. She said the state says to rely on the cell phone evidence when it matches with Jason's story, but don't worry about when Holly's phone is moving independently of theirs. She said to listen closely to what Jason has to say, telling the jury that suddenly, on January 20th of this year, he sold his death sentence to the state for what he hopes is very little additional time to serve in jail. Evidence will show that Zach Adams is not guilty of these charges, she said. The first witness was Holly's dad, Dana Bobo. He said the Bobo family lived off Swan Johnson Road near Parsons and had lived there since 1982. He worked for Mackenzie Tree Service, and his wife, Karen, worked as a teacher at the Scottsdale Middle School. On the morning Holly went missing, on April 13, 2011, he got up for work at 5:30 a.m. He didn't see Holly that morning, but he saw her light on underneath her door. He spoke to her through the door and then left for work. That was the last time he ever saw her. When he got the call that she was missing later that morning, he said his life changed as he knew it. He said they searched everywhere for Holly, but couldn't find her. Holly's boyfriend, Drew Scott, testified that he and Holly were in a serious relationship at the time of her disappearance, In fact, he had given her a promise ring at Christmas that prior year, and she wore that ring every day. He said he last saw Holly the night before she went missing. A man who lived next door to the Bobos, James Barnes, testified next. He recalled how he heard voices that sounded like arguing the morning Holly went missing.
About 7:50, sometime like that, I heard some arguing going on next door. So I kind of looked through the trees to see what was going on and couldn't see anything at all. And she started screaming a little and then she quit. And my girlfriend came outside, so I told her to get in the truck, and we went down and we sat at the end of the driveway for a few minutes and didn't see or hear anything, so we went ahead and went on to work.
All right. Before we go any further, were you outside when you first heard the screaming?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you remember what you heard or what words you heard?
It sounded like she was arguing with somebody, and she said, stop. I said, stop.
Stop.
Yeah.
Okay. And at that, when you heard that, did it sound frantic to you, or did you just think someone was messing around?
It sounded like she was arguing with somebody she knew. I mean, it didn't sound nothing serious, really. I mean,
at that point.
Yeah.
Okay, did something happen, or did you hear additional screams later that made you actually walk to the tree line?
Yeah, she kind of cut out mid-scream, and it just didn't sound right. And my dogs were raising Cain, so I kind of went over there to see what was going on. And like I said, I couldn't see anything from where I was at.
How long did the screaming last?
Maybe a minute, minute and a half. I mean.
And other than no and stop, did you hear? And you said her. Did it sound like it was a female's voice?
Yeah.
Other than the no and the stop, did you hear any other words?
No.
Got an answer?
No.
About 5 minutes later, after he had left his house, he said he called his mom and asked her to call Karen Bobo to see if everything was all right. Karen Bobo testified next. She said she was at work at the school when the secretary told her that her neighbor had called, saying she thought she had heard screams coming from the house. So she called her son, Clint.
I called Clint and I asked my son, Clint, what's going on? And he said, did Holly not have school today? And I said, yes, why? And he said, well, I think she's out here with Drew. And I don't know what made me say it. This instant panic came over me, and I said, that's not Drew. Call all the neighbors, I think is what I said. And then I ran over to the office, and I called 911. I don't remember exactly what I said, but I remember they said it was Henderson County. We live in Decatur County, so I hung up. I think I fell on the floor at that point. And I guess I called Clint back, but I don't really remember now if it was from the library phone or the office phone, and he was still talking about, was Holly not going to school today when she turkey hunting with Drew? And I said, that's not Drew. And at some point I said, get a gun and shoot him. And I remember Clint saying, you want me to shoot Drew? And then a friend of mine and co-worker, Terry Bromley, I think she pulled me up out of the floor. And she was pulling me to her. We were trying to get to her vehicle. And as soon as we got to her vehicle, I called 911 again. And I got Decatur County that time.
Karen said she knew that who Clint had seen with Holly wasn't Drew because she had spoken to Drew earlier that morning and knew that he was out turkey hunting. Karen's 911 call was played in court. She is frantic and tells them that someone has taken her daughter and to please get someone out there quick. Karen was then asked to identify some of Holly's belongings, but as she did so, she told the court that she wasn't feeling well. She became hysterical on the stand and said she felt like she couldn't breathe. Paramedics came in and the court abruptly recessed. When court came back into session, Karen was back on the stand after receiving medical attention for her panic attack. The defense team asked for a mistrial, but Judge Creed McGinley denied the request, saying that it was clearly a medical event, that she hadn't been faking it for the jury. But even so, he instructed the jury to not give her any sympathy due to her collapse. And so her testimony continued. Karen said that in the weeks after Holly's disappearance, she tracked down leads, including a lead about Zach Adams. She said in July 2011, she and Clint went to his house. She said she was Zach's fourth grade teacher, and so she knew him.
When we got there, I can't remember if he came to the door or the front door was open. And so he invited us in, and we went in just the living room part. And we sat down. I'm not sure he ever sat down. His behavior was, his voice was low 1 minute, loud the next. I don't remember a whole lot about what he said, but two things stand out to me that he said.
Right. And what is the first one?
He asked Clint to describe what the person looked like who walked away with Holly. And when Clint described him, he said that was Shane.
Okay.
And I just found that odd.
Okay. Did you know who Shane was?
I did.
Did you have him in school as well?
No, I did not.
Just knew who he was. Right. What was the second thing that he said?
He told me, this is just out of the blue, that he could call someone with his phone and make it look like it was coming from my phone.
So, did he use the word spoofing, or is that a word term you're familiar
with? He did use that word, but I didn't have a clue what it meant.
Okay. So those are the two things that you remember him saying?
Yes, ma'am.
She said that Zach, Jason, Shane, and Dylan's names kept coming up, and that she spoke with all of them in the following months. Holly's brother, Clint, testified that at the time Holly went missing, he had a part-time job and was going to school at the University of Tennessee at Martin. He was 25 years old at the time. He said he woke up that morning because the dog was barking. He heard voices and he looked out the window that looks out into the carport back area of their home.
How were the two voices talking to each other? In what manner were they talking to?
The male voice sounded somewhat aggravated, and the female voice would just answer back and sounded upset.
Could you actually hear the words that were being spoken?
No, I wasn't able to make out what they were saying.
So were you going by the tone or volume or something like that?
That's right.
Voices?
That's right.
And is all this happening over the course, because we talk about it here, and it sounds like this happened over the course of minutes, but in fact, it's happening over the course of what?
All of this is taking place just within a few minutes.
Okay. These voices, how long do you listen to them?
Well, I would say just less than minutes. I would say seconds.
Okay. So you're fresh out of sleep?
Yeah.
The barking dog, nothing out front. Looking out to the carport, and you hear these voices.
That's right.
For seconds.
Yes.
And what do you see when you lift up the blind a little bit?
I see the silhouette of two individuals knelt down underneath that window.
Can you see their faces?
No.
He said he then walked over to the back door and saw the male and female walking towards the woods. The male was wearing camouflage. He said he still thought that it was Drew, and even though his mom had been hysterical on the phone, telling him that it wasn't Drew, he said he still didn't understand the danger of it. He opened the door and felt how cold it was outside, so he went and got dressed, grabbed his gun and cell phone, and went outside. The male and female were gone, but he saw blood by the back door.
I walk out and I look to my left where they were knelt down under that window, and there's a pool of blood in the garage.
There's a garage and there's a carport.
Carport.
Which one is it?
It's a carport attached to the house.
It's the one that you were lifting up that blind and peeking into, right?
That's right.
And you were seeing the silhouettes of your sister and somebody. Yeah.
Yes.
And there's a pool of blood.
Yes, just below where they were knelt down.
And what are you thinking at this point?
I'm even more confused because I'm thinking now, if it is Drew or if it is Richie, they've killed a turkey, they've brought it up here to the house and laid it on the carport, and it's been bleeding, And
you're still not thinking that some man or some men came to your house that morning and abducted your sister and dragged her off in the woods?
Absolutely not.
Had that even crossed your mind at all?
No.
If that had crossed your mind, what would you have done?
The situation would have been much different. I would have probably not called anyone. I would have just got a gun and tried to kill the person that was with my sister.
Clint said the male he saw with Holly wasn't the same size as Zach Adams, but said Shane Austin does fit the description. He said he has no idea how many people were out there, that there could have been more that he didn't see. Lawrence James, a special agent forensic science supervisor with the TBI, testified about the blood found by the Bobo's back door as the images of the scene were displayed to the jury. He said there were about 50 to 60 blood drops and that one was a smear. He noted that there were lines within the smear, as though a pattern, perhaps from a pair of pants, had been impressed on it. He said his feeling was that either someone had knelt down into it or someone had blood on them and then knelt down and transferred it there. There was also a partial shoe print in the garage and a latent print found on the hood of Holly's car. James said that some of the blood spots matched Holly's and that the others couldn't be identified. He believed the dirt played a factor in that. Warren Rainey was an officer with the Tennessee Highway Patrol. He said he took part in the search for Holly for about 18 months. Zach Adams' name came up during the investigation, and so he visited his home twice. About 2 weeks after Holly's disappearance, he and another trooper went to Zach's house to see if he knew anything about what had happened. He said Zach answered the door and he started questioning him. He said Zach refused to give him his phone number, saying that his girlfriend had already given it to other agencies. He told Rainey that he didn't have anything to do with it, but Rainey noticed that he was visibly shaking. A lot, he said. Rainey said that as he was leaving the property, he looked in his rearview mirror and saw Zach start running back towards his house, which he thought was strange. He called the command post and told them that they needed to get people up there because he was suspicious of Zach Adams. The next day, he and a search team went out to the Adams property line and noticed a mattress leaning up against the house. A man named Stephen Young testified next, saying that Warren Rainey had asked him and some others to go search in the woods behind Zach's house. He said Warren had just got through talking to Zach and was suspicious of him. There were six of them, staked out in the woods, kneeling down, hiding and watching the house with binoculars. He said Zach came outside and started vacuuming out a black pickup truck that was in the shed behind the house. He said he saw two mattresses leaned up against the back of the house. Matthew Ross, a special agent with the FBI, testified about injuries he saw in Zach's arms and legs when he went to question him about Holly. He said about a week after Holly's disappearance, he went over to Zach's house and noticed visible scratches on his arms and legs. Photos he took of Zach that day were shown to the jury. Zach told him that he had gotten those scratches after being arrested by police in a nearby county. He said he had run through the woods trying to escape and was all cut up by the briars. The next witness countered that story, however. Chris Hill, who works at the Magistrate State Park, said that he made a traffic stop on Zach's white pickup truck on April 4th, 2011. He said at some point, Zach fled on foot and was pursued and arrested. After the arrest, he said he did not see any scratches on Zach's arms. They were not there, he said. Christy Claney, who lived in the same area as the Bobos, testified that one morning, just days before Holly's abduction, she decided to go for a walk in her neighborhood. She walked to Holly's street, Swan Johnson Road, and was on the way back when she saw a loud white truck idling on the street, less than a mile from Holly's house. She said it sat there for a few minutes and then slowly turned around and made its way towards her. She said she was thinking, "What are they doing?" She was growing alarmed and was thinking what she would do if something were to happen. Then the driver drove by really slow, looked over at her, and said, "Did I scare you?" She said no, and he said, I didn't mean to scare you. I thought you were a girl I know that lives around here. And then he repeated, I didn't mean to scare you. And he chuckled and then left. She texted her husband and told him, something really weird just happened with the white truck. Her husband then got her some mace to take with her from then on. She said that after Holly's disappearance, she told the police about what had happened and identified a photo of Zach Adams as the person that most fit the description of who she saw that morning. Zach's former girlfriend, Rebecca Earp, testified that she and Zach were dating in April 2011 when Holly disappeared. She said their relationship around that time was awful. His grandma had recently passed away, and he was doing morphine and meth. She lived with him on his grandfather's property. The day before Holly went missing, she said she tried to break up with him, and his response was stern and threatening. He talked her into staying with him that night, so she did. The next morning, the morning of Holly's abduction, she said Zach left the house early, around 7:30. He told her he was going to sell scrap, and he was acting normally. She said he was driving a white truck around that time. Later that day, she heard on the news that Holly was missing. Zach came by her work at Joe's Video in Parsons that afternoon. They got into an argument because she said she thought he was lying about having gone to the scrapyard that morning because he had switched phones. He had texted her from his brother Dylan's phone, which she said was unusual. He then left after they argued. The next day, she was at Zach's house, and Zach and Shane were there. The news came on, and Shane said something rather interesting.
I was cooking supper, and the news come on, and they were talking about Holly missing, and Shane kind of smirked and started laughing. And Zach made the comment, said, they'll never be able to find her.
They'll never be able to find her.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any more conversation about that at that time?
No. I didn't say anything. I just kept cooking.
You just kept cooking?
Mm-hmm.
She was then asked if she had noticed any physical injuries on Zach around that time.
Did you notice any physical injuries that Zach had around that time?
Yes, sir.
And what was that?
3 scratches on his neck.
Scratches on his neck?
Yeah, parallel scratches on his neck.
On his?
Neck.
Neck.
Okay. Yes.
And had you seen those before he went scrapping?
No.
Did he have those after he went scrapping?
Yes.
So according to Rebecca, when Zach left that morning to go scrapping, he didn't have the scratches. But later that afternoon, he did. But she said she never asked him about them. Rebecca continued to follow the news about Holly's case. She said Zach was familiar with the roads by Holly's house because they had driven around there together before. When she saw the route that Holly's cell phone had gone, it caught her attention because that was the route that Zach went all the time. She spent another 3 months living with Zach in his house. She never noticed anything strange, but when she finally left in July, she and Zach argued.
What did he say?
He said he would tie me up just like he did Holly Bobo and nobody would ever see me again.
And he'd tie you up like Holly Bobo and nobody would ever see you.
Yes, sir.
She heard him talk about Holly again within the next couple months.
It was at John Mitchell's house.
And who's, just generally, who is John Mitchell?
It's one of his friends.
His friend, you mean Zach's?
Yes.
What'd you hear?
That everything was ready to go in the back of the truck to be put up under the Birdsong Bridge.
To be put up under the Birdsong Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And they say what this was, it was going to be put up?
They said it was the remains of Holly. But when they found out that I found out about it, they said that it was remnants of making meth is what they got rid of.
On cross-examination, Rebecca told Jennifer Thompson that she was told by police officers after she had gotten pregnant and Zach was in custody that they would take her baby away if she didn't tell them the truth. She also admitted to having given different statements. In April 2011, she gave no indication that Zach was involved and said Zach's scratches were from running from the police. We'll hear from more witnesses right after this quick break from our sponsor. There are two things you probably hate doing: waiting and losing. Don't we all? But if you're a woman and you're not investing, you're doing both right now. You could actually be losing about $100 a day by waiting to invest. It's like a crisp new Benjamin flying out the window every day. But here's some good news. Elevest is an online investment platform for women where you can invest in specific life goals, such as buying a house, starting a business, or retiring your way on your terms. Elevest gives you a free, customized financial plan based on the goals you choose, shows you how much to invest every month until you reach those goals, and sets up recurring deposits to help you stay on track. All you have to do is get started. And now, My Court Junkie listeners will receive $100 towards your first funded goal when you sign up with Elevest. Visit elevest.com/court. That's ELLEVEST.com/court. The next few witnesses focused on Holly's personal belongings that were strewn about the community after her disappearance. John Graves, who lives about 5 miles north of Parsons and who knew the Bobo family, told the court that on April 14th, he was driving around when he saw something that looked out of place in a creek. He fished the object out and saw that it was a polka-dotted lunch bag with a sandwich inside. There was an embroidered H on the side of it. He called the authorities but said that he had already handled it at that time. Gerald Stevens, a local farmer, said that as he was searching, he noticed something pink on the side of the road. It was a pair of pink underwear. There was also a piece of paper that looked like Holly's homework with her name on it. This was right near Shane Austin's home. A classmate and family friend of Holly's named Emily Pratt said that on Easter, she went out looking with a group of searchers, and she found Holly's cell phone lying on top of a culvert. She said it looked like it had been placed there. Ednisha Brashear said that in May 2011, she and her brother went for a bicycle ride. They were playing the game I Spy when her brother said, "I spy a SIM card," as in a SIM card for a cell phone. She put the card into her phone and could hear different voicemail messages that sounded like they were for Holly. She found Holly's mom's contact info online and called to tell her what she had found. And then, the biggest discovery yet. Larry Stone, a ginseng hunter, testified that on September 7th, 2014, he was in the woods with his cousin in Decatur County looking for ginseng. He said he saw a bucket and picked it up. He thought to himself, "Why is a 3-gallon bucket sitting here upside down in the woods?" He said he then had what he described as a feeling to turn around, and so he did. He turned around and saw a human skull. He called his cousin over, who was about 300 yards away. He said he knew right away that it could be Holly. Laura Hodge, a special agent forensic scientist for the TBI, was part of the violent crime response team that responded to the scene. She said that in addition to the skull, other bones were found. Also in the area, they recovered a purse with a camera and a keychain with the letter H, a pack of gum, chapstick, a black hair tie, a piece of pink fabric that looked to be part of a t-shirt, a ring, and an earring. The deputy chief medical examiner, Marco Ross, performed an autopsy on Holly's remains. He said the bones that were recovered were Holly's skull, mandible, teeth, left shoulder blade, 6 ribs, and the upper part of her sternum. Ross testified that the patterns on her skull were typical of a gunshot wound to her head. He was unable to determine how close the gun was when it was fired, but noted that the trajectory was from the back of the skull to the front, right towards the left, and slightly downward. He said the size of the defect in the skull is consistent with a .32 caliber bullet. When asked if that wound would have been fatal, he said yes. The cause of death was a gunshot wound to the back of the head. The state's star witness was obviously Jason Autry. Going into his testimony, the questions trial watchers were wondering were, would Jason's testimony finally provide answers as to what happened to Holly Bobo? And even if he did, would he be a credible witness? Jason entered the courtroom wearing prison garb. Right away, prosecutor Jennifer Nichols addressed it, and Jason told the jury that he had also been charged in the case with murder, kidnapping, and rape. And prior to the case, he said he had been arrested for drugs and theft. When asked about his expectations to testify today, he said he's hoping for leniency. He said the prosecutor told him multiple times that he must tell the truth, and his attorneys told him to tell the truth, too. And so his story about what happened began. On April 12, 2011, the night before Holly's abduction, he spent the night at his girlfriend Angela's house. He was not working at the time. He woke up at 6:30 the next morning, and after Angela got ready for work, she dropped him off at his car, a PT Cruiser, which was parked at the local Quick Mart. He wanted to get his hands on some morphine, a drug he was addicted to, along with methamphetamine and hydrocodone. His drug of choice was meth and morphine together, and he already had the meth. He called Zach and Shane but couldn't get a hold of them right away. Eventually, at about 8:40 a.m., he got a hold of Zach, who called him back and said that he was busy, but he would call him once he got to his cousin's house. Zach then called him again and said that he was at his cousin's and needed his help. When he pulled into the driveway, he noticed a large fire burning in a burn barrel. Dylan was standing in the doorway of the trailer with his shirt off, and Shane was walking around with a gun in his holster, yelling that they all needed to hurry up and get the hell out of there. Zach was standing at the door of his white pickup truck. Jason walked over to Shane and got a morphine pill from him. He then immediately went back to his car and shot it. He walked over to the truck where Zach was, and that's where Zach told him that he needed help burying a body. He said he thought the body was a guy named Jojo at first, because Jojo had owed Zach some money, and Zach had talked about killing him a few days prior. But Zach said, "That's Holly Bobo." Jason said at the time he didn't know who Holly Bobo was. He described to the jury what the body looked like.
The body was laying in a multicolored farm blanket, farm-style blanket. It looked like multiple colors. Wrapped in the blanket, laying up against the back. Say the truck is sitting here. It's laying against the back.
He said he was willing to help Zach, but that he wanted to get his car away from there because he didn't want Shane or Dylan to know that he was getting involved. He told Zach to meet him at Yellow Springs Church, and he would park his car there and then get in the truck with him. He left his car in the church parking lot and got into the truck with Zach. He asked him how they were going to bury the body with no tools, no shovels, or pickaxes. Jason suggested going under the Interstate 40 bridge, saying that he had seen a body there before, but that body had been floating, and he had an idea how to make this one sink.
Why did you mention a body floating? What did you talk about specifically? What was your plan of disposing of Holly's body?
Mr. Gutter, put her in the deep end of the slough. I told him, I said, you put her in the deep end of that slough, turtles, and she had to eat it up, just like that. The only thing holding the other body up was the gases and the guts. I mean, it was floating, just like I'm from the river. You see a dead fish, the only thing holding it up is the gases and the intestines. That's the same as it was. You get the guts out, down it goes.
So you had a good idea?
I understand, yeah. Yes, ma'am.
All right.
They scoped out the area and backed the truck up to a pile of riprap.
I got out of the truck with the right hand and I grabbed the upper torso of Miss Bobo. Jack come around, let the tailgate down. I brought the upper torso to the end of the tailgate where he grabbed the legs, and I set the head, the upper end, on the riprap pile.
Did you notice anything about the blanket or the truck, the bed of the truck? Did you see anything?
In the bed of the truck, there appeared to be a small amount of blood at the upper end of the torso that I grabbed. Had a small blood spot, maybe the size of an orange. Maybe the size of an orange.
He said as they were putting her body on the pile of riprap, he realized that Holly was still alive.
I'm standing over the top of her with my hands upon my knees. She's being right here. And at that time, I see a foot move, a movement, and a sound of distress that sound like, come out of the voice, come from the blanket. At that time, I walked to the door, to the passenger side door of the pickup, and Mr. Adams was digging in a fanny pack. I told him, I said, this fucking bitch is still alive. We just stopped for a second. I walked to the front of the truck. And I told Jack, I said, she's heard my name called and heard me talking and all. At that time, he wheels around, walks back to the driver's side pickup. Out of the floorboard of the pickup, he pulls a pistol, the same pistol that was holstered on Mr. Austin's side at 30 Alice Springs Road. And I said, whoa.
Jason said whoa because he wanted to make sure that no one was coming. When he saw that the coast was clear, he called out to Zach.
I looked around and I told him to... There was nothing coming close as clear, something to that effect. And at that time, boom, the gun sounded, the gun went off. And it sounded like to me that it shot 3-4 times underneath that bridge. I had done made it back. I had done started my way back this way, and it sounded like boom, boom, boom underneath that bridge. It was just one shot, but it echoed underneath that bridge all the way down that damn river bottom. And when that gun went off, it was Martins went everywhere.
I'm sorry, didn't hear that.
Martins, bridge, birds went everywhere. Just all up under that bridge. And it just dead silence for just a second.
Zach had shot Holly, and the shot had echoed under the bridge. He said he heard a boat start up, and so he ran back towards the truck, telling Zach that they had been heard. They loaded her body back into the truck, and Jason noted that there was now a blood spot the size of a grapefruit on the blanket. They then got into the truck and drove out of there as quickly as they could. Jason told Zach he needed to get to Benton County and meet Angela for lunch, something that was his daily routine. He said at that point, he realized he had made some big mistakes, and he was looking to put some distance between himself and, quote, that situation. On the way back to his car, he and Zach talked about how this had happened. Zach told him that he knew who Holly was from her cousin, Natalie. He said Natalie worked at a strip club he went to, and had showed him pictures of Holly, saying that he could have a threesome with them. Zach also claimed that Holly had been to his house before. Jason said he went back to his car, but realized he couldn't make it to the lunch in time, so he sat at the side of the road in his car, texting Angela through her lunch period. He said Zach went back to Shane's, which was less than a mile away. He spoke to Zach again at about 2:15, when he called him, asking if he could get another morphine pill. Zach knew a guy named Victor Dinsmore, who they typically purchased the pills from. They met back up at Zach's house. He said Shane, Dylan, and Zach were all outside. The white pickup truck was not there. He said it was obvious that there was thick animosity in the air, like a fight had just occurred. They all got into Dylan's pickup truck and drove less than 2 miles to where Victor was, at a woman he called Miss Dottie's house. Once they got there, he said Zach and Shane started arguing. He said Shane said, "You didn't have to kill her." And Zach said, "You're just as guilty. You hit it." Meaning that Shane had sex with her. Victor came out and broke up the fight, and they purchased the pills from him. Jason said he heard Zach tell Victor that he had hit his truck at Victor's shop earlier that morning. They then went back to Zach's house, and Shane left. 2 days later, Jason talked to Zach again about what had happened. They met behind the Marathon gas station on Interstate 40. Zach approached his car and got inside. They started smoking meth, and Jason asked what he did with that girl, and Zach said he threw her out by Kelly Bridge. But he said that wasn't the reason why they were meeting. Zach told him that Dylan wouldn't stop talking about it and asked if Jason would kill his brother. Jason told him that he would think about it. After their meeting in his car, Jason went to Shane's house. He said Shane was highly inebriated. There were search parties going on everywhere, looking for Holly, and a command post was set up at Yellow Springs Church. He described Shane as being frantic, and so they went to Johnny's Bar and Grill. Later, he spoke with Zach again and told him that he had thought about the offer and that he was thinking about going through with it, meaning killing Dylan. He asked if the offer was still good, and Zach said yes. He said about a day or so after that, he surprised Dylan, knowing that his grandfather wasn't home. He said he showed up with a boat and some marijuana and lured him into going to the river with him, telling him that they would go bass fishing. They went to the Tennessee River and started bass fishing. They had been there, drinking, smoking, and fishing for about an hour or so. He was looking for a place to do it when another boat came over. The person in that boat knew Dylan's grandfather, and Jason said since they had been spotted, he couldn't go through with it. While they were fishing, he said Dylan got inebriated and started talking. Now, what Dylan said to him could not be heard by the jury due to it being hearsay, but he said that Dylan told him certain things about what had happened on April 13th. And in response to what Dylan told him, he went over to his and Shane's grandmother's vacant barn. The purpose was to clean up any possible evidence left behind, but he didn't see anything. He said he also went to Kelly Ridge, where Zach said he dumped Holly. He said there were two ponds there, and he saw buzzards by an old dead tree, which he took as a sign that there was something dead there. There was a house on the property, and so he knocked on the door and asked the person there if he could go fishing in their ponds. They told him no, that they didn't want anyone on the property, and so he left. Then, in August 2012, he had another conversation with Zach about Holly. They were again smoking meth. Jason said he looked at Zach and said, "Looks like we got by with this shit." He said Zach then told him how he claims it all went down the morning Holly was abducted. Now you'll hear the judge interject that this is not to be taken as the truth, but as what Jason says he was told by Zach.
He said the real reason that we were there was to show Clint how to manufacture meth. He said we got there early, she come outside screaming and raising hell, and we took her.
Right. That's not offered for the truth of it. Besides that, it's allegedly a statement of the defendant, not a third party.
Jason said that Zach told him that all three of them, Zach, Shane, and Dylan, then raped Holly. He said he never had any other conversations with Zach about it after that. Jason also identified the murder weapon in court, saying that it had been Shane's. After Holly's murder, he said he saw the gun again when he and Shane traded the gun to Victor Dinsmore for more morphine about 4 or 5 months after Holly was killed. Jason said that in the months that followed, in July 2011, he was questioned by police at least twice. He was also questioned by Karen Bobo.
Any of those interviews, either the one by the Bobos or the two by the Bobos or law enforcement, did you ever tell the truth about what you knew?
I did not.
Why? That's probably pretty obvious, but why?
One was self-preservation. Once. Two, I had family in it. Three, I had a relationship I was trying to save. I didn't want to get destroyed.
You lied.
Plain and simple.
And after you were actually arrested for this crime, did you continue to lie?
I did.
After his arrest, Jason maintained his innocence and wrote letters that said he didn't have anything to do with it. He said he knew that his mail was being read, and so he continued to say that he had no knowledge of anything, even though he did. Then, in the fall of 2016, the situation changed for him. He agreed to cooperate. After Jason's testimony, the prosecution called witnesses to the stand, whom they hoped would corroborate his story. Brenda O'Brien testified that her parents lived by Kelly Ridge in a town called Holiday, where Zach had told Jason he dumped Holly's body. She said that on that Saturday after Holly went missing, she was at her parents' house with her mom and sister, while her father and brother-in-law were helping with the search for Holly. She recalled being in the kitchen when a silver PT Cruiser came up to the driveway. She said a man walked up and asked her if he could fish in their ponds. She told him that he would have to ask her dad, who was out searching for Holly. She said when she mentioned Holly's name, the man appeared to get very stressed. He ran his fingers through his hair and said, okay, that he may come back later. A few days later, she reported it to the police because she said the way he reacted to Holly's name and the fact that he had asked to fish, which had never happened before, was odd. Victor Dinsmore testified next. Right off the bat, the prosecutor asked him about his prior criminal history, and he admitted to having been convicted of rape when he was 23 years old and spending 2 years in the penitentiary. He also admitted to selling drugs, specifically morphine, back in 2011. He told the court that on the day Holly went missing, he was doing some work at a woman he called Miss Dottie's house when Zach, Shane, and Jason pulled up in Dylan's truck. He said they smoked a joint, and within 2 or 3 minutes, Shane and Zach started arguing and fighting. He recalled them arguing over, quote, who was going to hit it first. He said Jason broke up the fight and they left. He didn't recall giving Jason a morphine pill then. He also said he didn't recall Zach telling him anything about hiding his truck at his shop. But, he said, he did remember that Zach did hide it there sometime after Holly's disappearance. A couple months later, he said Shane brought him a gun and that he had never brought him a pistol before. Jason was with him and they traded the gun for pills. He thought he could make a profit off of it, but he ended up giving the gun to his wife to protect herself after what had happened to Holly. Before he moved away to Indianapolis, later that year in 2011, he told his wife that she needed to get rid of the gun. He said he was afraid that it had killed somebody. After he told her that, he never saw the gun again. In 2016 or early 2017, he spoke with TBI and the prosecutors. He finally told them about where his wife told him that the gun could be found. And shortly after, investigators found it. Brent Booth, a special agent with the TBI, testified about the investigation itself and the mistakes he thought were made in the very beginning. He said that very early on, Zach, Shane, and Jason's names came up in the investigation, but many others did as well. He said they paid more attention to the tips that claimed Holly was still alive, tied up in a basement, and things like that. Terry Britt was a sex offender in the area whom they focused on. We took Terry Britt's life apart, he said. We looked at him hard. He said they kept him under physical surveillance, wiretapped his phones, wiretapped his house, and interviewed people close to him, but they didn't find anything related to Holly. He admitted that they weren't thorough with reading the reports, especially about Zach, Jason, Dylan, and Shane. The left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing, he said. We didn't realize what was there. For example, he said they didn't check out their alibis thoroughly, and they weren't interviewed very early on. Why not? Prosecutor Hagerman asked. I don't know. Overwhelmed? Too much coming in too fast, Booth replied. We're not that big of an agency. He called it a mistake. He recounted how Holly's property was found in various places in the community and showed a map that pinpointed each item and where it was discovered. Like a paper with Holly's name on it that was found by Shane's house, close to Yellow Springs Church, and a receipt from her school's bookstore, along with a dollar bill, that was found in front of Shane's grandma's house, about a mile and a half from Shane's house, and anatomy and physiology papers consistent with Holly's studies that were discovered near where her remains were eventually found. Booth said the investigation refocused in January 2014 in the form of a phone call. After that call, he was interested in speaking to Zach, Jason, Shane, and Dylan, even though he thought they had already been checked out. But they went back and started from day one and discovered that their alibis were false and had never been checked out. Years later, in March of 2014, after Zach was arrested, they tore up his house through searches, but found no trace of Holly. But they didn't know that they should have been checking Shane's grandmother's barn at that time. He recalled the morning he responded to the area where Holly's remains were found and told the jury that they were about 3 miles from Shane's house and 5 miles from Zach's. They searched the surrounding areas and found her wallet, keys, driver's license, and that promise ring that her boyfriend Drew had given to her that she wore every day. On cross-examination, Booth admitted that the pink underwear they found did not have any traces of Holly on them and could possibly not be hers. Defense attorney Jennifer Thompson pointed out that at one point the Bobos were looked into and that they had even filed a search warrant for their bank records. Booth also told the court that all four suspects, Zach, Jason, Shane, and Dylan, were excluded as the owner of the palm print found on Holly's Mustang. Thompson brought up the fact that investigators had not only thoroughly searched Zach's house, but also his four different vehicles, as well as his grandfather's house, and there was none of Holly's DNA found anywhere. There was also no .32 ammunition, the ammunition from the alleged murder weapon, recovered from the Adams home either. Prosecutors then called Michael Frizzell, a special agent in charge with the TBI, to the stand to go over the cell phone records for Zach, Jason, and Holly. He started by saying that there was no activity on any of the four defendants' phone records during the time Holly was abducted. Their phones may have been turned off, they just didn't receive or make any calls, or they were in an area with no reception. Holly's phone, however, recorded activity from 7:30 a.m. to 9:06 a.m. Holly's last outgoing call was at 7:42 a.m., and all activity after that was incoming. Prosecutors believe Holly was taken at some time before 7:50 a.m. They were able to track what cell phone towers Holly's phone pinged off of, and here's a summary of what they found. Holly's phone started out by her house, then went north towards the Yellow Springs Holiday Tower. During that same time, Zach's phone and Jason's phone were also in that area. Zach's phone had started out by his house, and Jason's had started up by Camden near Angela's house. But then Zach and Jason's phones moved towards the Tennessee River, while Holly's goes in a different direction. But at that same time as the final ping from Holly, Dylan's phone is unaccounted for. Then, at 11:16 a.m., Zach's phone pings not far from where Holly's phone and SIM card were ultimately recovered from. A friend of Holly's named Candace testified that the weekend before Holly went missing, she and her boyfriend went with Holly and Drew to the Decatur County Fairgrounds to attend the annual coon hunt. While they were there, she saw a man dressed in camouflage who kept looking flirtatiously at her and Holly. It made her so uncomfortable that she tugged on her boyfriend's sleeve and said, "Let's go," so they could get away from him. She described him as being tall, fat, with reddish-tinted hair. Holly went missing a few days later, and she told Holly's mom and the police about the man she had seen. She was asked to assist a sketch artist, and they came up with a sketch that was shown to the jury. She said the man resembled Shane Austin. Prosecutors showed a photo of Shane back-to-back with a photo of the sketch, and the similarities were striking. A 911 dispatcher, John Maxwell, testified that Zach's grandfather, Dick Adams, called 911 three times the night of April 13, 2011, the same day Holly went missing. In the first call, Dick Adams told him that Zach was raising hell again, that he was messed up on something, and that he was trying to get his brother Dylan's keys. In the second call, Dick told them not to come to the house, that Zach had left. But on the third call, he said Zach had come back, causing problems and was trying to get a gun. Officers responded to the home, but less than 20 minutes later, they left. No arrests were made. The next witness seemed to be more of a preemptive one for the prosecution. They called Terry Britt to the stand, the registered sex offender who had been a main suspect in Holly's disappearance early on in the investigation. Terry told Prosecutor Hagerman that he was currently incarcerated for kidnap and attempted rape. And after he's finished with that sentence, he will do federal time on gun charges. He said he has other convictions in his history, too, for rape, robbery, burglary, and receiving stolen property. He's 58 years old now, but has served a total of 25 years in prison throughout his life. In 2011, Terry was living in Parsons with his wife, Janet. Prior to hearing that Holly was missing, he said he didn't know her or her family. He was questioned in Holly's disappearance on the morning she went missing. He said they came up with a couple charges so they could hold him in jail all day while they searched his house, shed, and garage. He said when he got back into his home, it was a mess. They had cut up his couch, busted his door in, took his van and computers. He said he did not kidnap, rape, or murder Holly, and that he had never seen her in his life. On cross-examination, Terry was asked what he was doing the morning Holly disappeared. He said that at about 8 a.m. or a little after, he and his wife went to All Good Salvage in Camden looking for a bathtub. They went to another store and then back to the original store before buying it. He said he has a receipt for that. He said they were back from their errands by noon. The next few witnesses focused on things Zach himself allegedly had told to other people about Holly's abduction and murder and his possible involvement. A man named Anthony Phoenix testified that he used to live in Parsons and knew Zach, Shane, Jason, and Dylan. He said he used to have a drug problem and was in jail on meth charges when Holly was abducted. He said when he first heard about it, he immediately wondered where Zach was when she went missing. He was released from jail in October, and he started hanging out with Zach again. He said whenever the subject of Holly going missing came up, Zach would act sketchy and nervous. He said Zach told him that he had met with Karen Bobo and was really concerned about whether she believed what he told her. Another time, he and Zach were riding around, and Zach made the comment, "Let's rape this bitch." He then said, "I couldn't have picked a prettier bitch." Anthony said it clicked for him that he was talking about Holly, and he told Zach that he didn't want to hear about it. Zach then said, "It sure was fun." Jamie Darnell, another friend of Zach's, said that Zach came over one night to do some drugs. While they were hanging out, Zach took out a knife, and Jamie asked him how much he wanted for it. Zach told him that if he knew what that knife had done, he probably wouldn't want to hold it. Jamie asked, "Does it involve what I think it does?" And he said Zach smiled at him and so he gave the knife back. Jamie said he was sure he was referencing Holly's case. He said Zach then pulled out a gun and shot it in the living room, out the front door. His girlfriend was sitting in the living room, and the shot went directly over her head. He said he pushed the gun down and pushed Zach out of the door and told him that he couldn't do that in his house. He said he was scared and surprised. Zach started crying and apologized. Jamie said he told him that he couldn't come back to the house until he cleared his name of the rumors going around that Zach had killed Holly. Zach said he couldn't do that. He was too far involved in it. He then showed him bruises on his arms and said, "This is what meth does to you from shooting it." Jamie told the court that he could tell that the drugs were making him act crazy. Carl Statler, another friend of Zach's, said that in the summer of 2012, he was riding around with Zach in his truck when Zach said, "I let Shane hit it." He said he believed it meant that Zach had let Shane rape Holly. He said he didn't want to know about it, and so he didn't ask any questions. He was also at a bar with Zach on a different day, at Johnny's Bar and Grill, and Zach said to the female bartender, "I'll kill you like I did Holly Bobo." And another time they were at Johnny's, he said, "I did it." Carl said he didn't ask any more questions, but he reported it to the TBI. And then a few former inmates who had been housed with Zach testified. Corey Rivers recalled how one day Zach walked by a cell and saw him reading the Bible. He asked Corey about forgiveness, if God would ever forgive him. Corey told him that God will forgive him. Just be honest, no matter what the situation is he's going through. Corey said as time went on, he asked Zach about what happened.
He really didn't go into much detail. He was just like, you know, him and a couple of his friends got drunk and, you know, they went.
Stop you here. Did he say a couple of his friends or did he say a family member and another guy?
He didn't elaborate on that. He just said a couple of his friends that went into the, you know, they got drunk and they went into the woods with this girl. And, you know, one thing led to another. And then he was like, you know, I was there for the worst of it. And I was like, "Well, did you do it?" And he was like, I was there for the worst of it." And he just left it like that. We never really got into detail about that. That's when the subject again got on about the forgiveness and just be honest. And no matter what the outcome is, at least you're right with God, you know. So it just went on like that.
Zach told him that they had cut the body up and that the upper torso had been found. Corey said he then reached out to law enforcement and told them what Zach had said. He said he never asked them for anything and didn't want anything. His case was over by that time. When it came time for him to get out in June, Zach mentioned a video.
So what did he tell you about the video?
He told me that it was something, you know, he had something he wanted to show me. He wanted to tell me to look up when I get out by the video.
Did he make any reference to it being right under the noses?
Oh, yes. He said, yes, ma'am. He told me it was right under the nose of, you know, the people who's looking into this.
But that what? They hadn't found it?
No, they haven't found it.
Sean Cooper testified that he and some other inmates were sitting on a bench in the courthouse hallway when he was told that he would be going to serve time in another county. He said Zach, whom he didn't know at the time, was sitting there too and asked him, "You know who I am?" Sean said no. He said, "I'm Zachary Adams from the Holly Bobo murder case." He wanted to know if Sean would be able to talk to any federal prisoners when he goes to that other jail. Zach told him that his brother Dylan was there and told him to tell his brother that if he didn't keep his mouth shut, quote, "I'm going to put him in a hole beside her." Another inmate who was there corroborated Sean's story and added another detail. He said that after that, Zach went into the courtroom for his arraignment, and when he came out, he said, "I got $2 million. I guess you gotta kill a bitch to get that kind of bail around here." Prosecutor Hagerman put up a photo taken from Zach's Facebook page, a close-up of him with a beanie on, looking as though he might be in the woods, with the title, "Who Am I Looking For?" Yet another inmate, Chris Swift, testified that he was at the same jail as Zach was in 2016. He said one day, Zach passed him and noticed that he was praying. He asked him if he thought that God would forgive him.
He asked me if I thought that, God would forgive him. And I'd asked him, I said, forgive you for what? And he said, my case. And so what do you mean? And he said, the Holly killing.
But that wasn't all. He said Zach brought up killing Holly again the next day.
It was over, couple day period here he wasn't involved in the killing is how he worded it. He said, I wasn't involved in the killing. I was involved in the worst part of it. And I didn't press him for anything further. I didn't really want to know any of that, and he'd let me know that, it was some boy that hung himself, and I guess it was his brother that was involved in the killing is what he said.
Okay. Did he mention the rape?
Yeah, he said that they were in a back room having sex with her. So.
Who was in the back room having sex with
her? His brother and some boy that hung himself.
Okay. And did he say something went wrong?
Yeah. He said something went bad wrong. And, he said he was involved in the worst part of it.
He was involved in the worst part of it. But he didn't tell you specifically if the part that he was involved in was the rape, or if the part that he was involved in was the kidnapping, or if the part that he was involved in was the murder.
No, sir.
Or if the part that he was involved in was the disposal of the body.
Correct. And he didn't.
He told you that he was involved in the worst part.
In the worst part of it.
And he wanted to be forgiven for that.
Correct. All he said was he wasn't involved in the killing.
Chris said he told his lawyer about the conversations and then told the TBI. At another time, Zach told him that as soon as the trial was over, he would be going home, saying they didn't have a body, didn't have a murder weapon, and didn't have a motive. But then he had a meeting with his attorney, and everything changed. He said it didn't look good for him, although he didn't go into detail. He said he was going to get the death penalty. Then, after another meeting with his attorney, he was pretty depressed and said to Chris, maybe I should just pray about it. Chris said he took that as a threat. He said Zach called him from another prisoner's inmate number once he got out and said, I probably wouldn't be talking to anybody else. He said he took that as another threat. And with that, the prosecution rested their case. The defense started by calling Shane Austin's mom, Rita Austin, to the stand. She said she went to visit her nephew, Jason Autry, in jail and found out that he had access to the evidence in the case. He told her that Holly had been shot in the back of the head and the bullet had come out under her right eye. With regard to Shane's suicide, she said he was down in Florida at the time, working to get his life straight. He had been using drugs again. She said he was making $1,500 a week, but when they looked in his bank account after he died, he only had $200. She said right before he committed suicide, he was fired from his job. He had a plane ticket to come back to Tennessee, but was so messed up at the airport that he didn't get on the plane. So instead, he went to a motel and killed himself. One of Rita's sisters and aunt to both Jason and Shane testified that on April 13th, 2011, she was at their family property on Yellow Springs Road and said that if someone had been screaming at any point, she would have heard it. She also said that 2 days after Holly went missing, she searched the property with a group of searchers, and nothing was out of the ordinary. On cross-examination, she admitted that if Holly had been drugged, restrained, and unable to scream, however, she wouldn't have been able to hear it. The defense had a star witness of their own, too, in the form of Terry Dykus, a now attorney who was a former criminal investigator with the TBI. In fact, he was the original case agent on Holly's case from April 13, 2011 through June 2013. Dykus said Zach's name came up very early during the first week of the investigation. He said they interviewed him and ran cadaver dogs through his trailer on Yellow Springs Road. He said the dogs didn't hit on anything, and Zach, Shane, and Dylan told police that they were together that day, while Jason had a different alibi. Zach's full alibi was that he was at home with his brother Dylan and girlfriend Rebecca at the time of the kidnapping. He said they woke up and left between 9 and 10 that morning to pick up Shane in Dylan's black pickup truck. They went and got about $5 worth of gas and then went up to Parsons, where gas is much cheaper, something Dyka said he knew to be true. Zach said when they were there, they noticed a wave of police cars and black SUVs flying down the interstate, likely responding to Holly's abduction. They pulled surveillance video from the businesses nearby and were able to corroborate that there were police cars and black SUVs going down the interstate at that time, as Zach had described. And just a few minutes after that, at 11:07 a.m., you could see a black pickup truck, a truck similar to what Zach says he was in, on the video too. Dyka said they also checked Zach's phone records, as well as Holly's. He said that at 8:28 a.m., Zach's phone pinged off a tower several miles from a tower where Holly's phone hit off of at 8:26 a.m. So he determined that Zach could not have been involved in the kidnapping. Dykus admitted that throughout the investigation, these guys' names kept on coming up for stupid reasons. He said they would hear that the four men would say things like, "I'm going to do this to you like I did Holly," so they kept checking them out. In July 2011, he said he decided that he was going to look into them and put it to rest for good. He spoke to Jason first, then Zach and Dylan, and then Rebecca. After he spoke with Rebecca, he determined that he was wasting his time investigating, quote, "these idiots." He said there were many other potential suspects they looked into and discounted as well. But then he went over the investigation into Terry Britt. He said Terry caught his interest because he was the exact size of what Clint Bobo said the abductor looked like, and his criminal history indicated that he was capable of the crime. He said Terry's alibi was weak. He claimed that he had been with his wife, purchasing a bathtub, but Dyka said that Terry's wife had been with him before when he had picked up a woman and then tried to sexually assault her. He noted that Karen Bobo was also suspicious of Terry, that she had called him about a week after Holly's disappearance and asked him to look into someone her niece called Chester the Molester. She told him that Natalie and Holly were at the Dollar General store a couple weeks before the kidnapping, and Terry was there, staring at them. That same day that Karen called him, Dyka said he was dealing with a report from a frantic girl who said Terry was stalking her and wouldn't stop. She had blonde hair and blue eyes too and looked a lot like Holly. The girl said that on three separate occasions, Terry had followed her. She got his tag number and found him on the sex offender registry and got his name. Dyka said they got more information from numerous girls in Decatur County who said that Terry had been stalking them too, a total of 8 different women. Some said it happened a few years back, but all information was similar. He said one woman was a deputy sheriff's wife, and he said, "Think about how brazen you would have to be to do that. As brazen as kidnapping someone from their carport." Dyka said that the night prior to Holly's disappearance, Terry and his wife had delivered newspapers until 3:10 a.m. But they then decided to get up that morning to get a bathtub to replace one that had been leaking for weeks. And what's more, his wife Janet went into work later at a local newspaper, but then left after Terry called her. Dyka said that was odd because it was the biggest news day in the history of Tennessee. He said at about 1:45 p.m., investigators went to look for Terry Britt to question him, but that he and Janet weren't home. Terry and Janet produced a receipt from the bathtub they reportedly purchased that morning from All Good Salvage, but Dyka said he went to the store and spoke to every employee. He was not able to find anyone who could verify that Terry had been there that day, and no receipts that matched what Terry and Janet had showed him. After that, he said he wiretapped Terry's home, cars, and cell phones, and also got a search warrant. On January 25th, 2012, he interviewed Terry at his attorney's office and recorded it. He then let Clint Bobo listen to it to see if he recognized the voice. Clint couldn't positively identify it, although he said he was 80% sure that it was Terry. From the wiretaps, Dykus said he found out that Janet was not involved in Holly's kidnapping. He also said Terry mentioned in the wiretap, "Watch what you say, I bet they bugged the area." He said Terry's residence was at the geographic center of where Holly's personal belongings had been found. And then an eerie discovery from a search warrant executed on Terry's home. Terry had a lock shed in the back of their house, and inside it, they found a highlighted photo from the New Leader, the newspaper in Parsons where Janet worked, of the girl he had been accused of stalking. The girl had received a scholarship and was featured. And Holly had received that same scholarship and had also been previously featured. He said that Terry was also not excluded from the palm print on Holly's Mustang. In his cross-examination, Prosecutor Hagerman tried to show that Dykus had left the investigation in 2013 and therefore wasn't aware of all of the developments in the case that had occurred since, and also tried to point out that Dykus's way of thinking may have been flawed. For example, Shane, Dylan, and Zach had all said they were together that day. They alibied each other. But Jason's original alibi hadn't checked out. Dykus said he still didn't find that suspicious because he believed that the crime had been a sexual one, committed by one person, and Jason didn't fit the description that Clint Bobo gave. But as Prosecutor Hagerman pointed out, he could have missed important evidence by assuming that he was only looking for one person.
Is that assumption back then? What led you to ignore these alibis between Dylan and Zach and Shane about being with each other, about Jason's alibi not checking out? I mean, is that what happened? Is that why you ignored that?
I didn't ignore it, sir. I didn't ignore it at all. But I've got eyes, and I look at Jason Autry. Okay, if Clint Bobo is lying about what the abductor looked like, then I don't know who did it, okay? We'll never know. But if he's telling the truth, it was not Jason Autry. You can go through that as much as you want to, but it always comes back to that.
It's the same assumption that one man did it. What it always comes back to, which you just talked about, the person that took her into the woods, doesn't fit the description of Jason Autry.
It doesn't.
Doesn't fit the description of Zach Adams.
It doesn't.
But you know what? You know who Clint Bobo said it fit the description of? Shane Austin.
Okay. If Shane Austin had a car at the time, that would...
If Shane Austin had a car at the time, well, he did. But you know what Zach had at the time?
Connor. Please ask questions. He's not asking questions.
No, he just did. So you know what kind of car Zach had?
Zach had a, I believe it was supposed to be tore up, but he had a white Nissan pickup at the time.
Supposed to be tore up.
Right.
He actually had two trucks. He had a black one and a white one. Do you remember that or not?
Well, there was one lead that came in that Jason Autry and Zach Adams were fishing one day, pulling a boat with a black truck. So I was saying you might be right there.
So two trucks.
Okay.
Including the white one that you said was supposed to be tore up.
Right.
Would it surprise you to learn that Zach Adams told investigators that around that time he was driving that white truck?
Nothing would surprise me at this point.
Hagerman brought up the surveillance video, where you could see a black truck in the area Zach says he was at. Hagerman pointed out that you couldn't tell whose truck that was in the video. And not only that, but if that was Zach in that truck, it was heading south, meaning that it could have been heading towards an area where some of Holly's property had been later found. Hagerman asked Dykus if either Zach or Jason had told him that they went to the Tennessee River that morning. Dykus said no, and admitted that had he known some of the details that had come up later in the investigation, it would be, quote, interesting. But instead, Hagerman said, Dykus moved on to Terry Britt. Dykus said that Terry's size was exactly what they were looking for, that he perfectly matched what Clint Bobo said the abductor had looked like. Hagerman asked him if Clint testified that Shane was the exact body type he saw. Would that surprise you? Dykus responded, Clint is a very honest young man, so I would believe him. But he pointed out that Clint had initially said the man had shoulder-length black hair, not Shane's reddish-brown hair. Hagerman then asked, were you aware that Zach told Karen Bobo that the man that had walked Holly into the woods was Shane? Dykus said, I did not know that. I did not know that. Also on cross-examination, Hagerman brought up the fact that even with all of the searches and wiretaps, no evidence linked Terry to Holly. A senior inspector with the U.S. Marshals, John Walker, testified that Terry Dykus had asked him to go interview Terry Britt, who was in custody on another charge, in March 2013. He said he was asked to see if Terry Britt would be interested in some kind of deal in the Holly Bobo case. He said at first, Terry told him that he didn't know who Holly was, but Walker told him that he knows that he's a sociopath and has an issue with women. He said Terry just sat there and nodded. Walker then told him what he believed happened, saying that Terry had probably seen Holly at the dollar store a couple weeks prior and then started stalking her.
And I said, her brother describes you as being 5'10 to 5'11, 200 pounds, barrel-chested, skinny legs, black hair that went over your collar, probably wearing a baseball cap, a camouflage jacket, blue jeans, and some type of work boots. And when I said that to him, he replied to me, that boy don't know what he saw. And I said, you got in your car around 8 o'clock. You drove north using the least traveled roads or with the fewest houses. You got to the freeway around 8:30. You spent about 25 minutes near the freeway. And I said, when you left that area, you started throwing things of Holly's out along Yellow Springs Road, such as a receipt, a wadded piece of paper, a dollar bill. And I said, you stopped when you got near your house and you headed down and threw the rest of the items, the larger items, into the creek on Gooch Road. That's around 9:25. And I said, you would know that creek on Gooch Road because you drive down that road to go home. And I said, when you came out of that, you got home probably around 9:35. And your wife awoke, Jan awoke, when the dogs were barking. And about before I finished saying that final word, he interrupted me and looked at me very, very straightforward and said, he said, sounds like you have it all figured out. I'll plead to it and you can close the case. I was very surprised by his comment. I didn't expect him to say that. I thought for a moment. I said, well, you got to do better than that. You got to give us her body. And he made a comment that I didn't understand at the time. His comment was, I can't give you something I don't have. I said, well, I need TBI here to finish this up. I do not want to take a statement from him. I was not there to get testimonial evidence. I said, TBI needs to be here. I got to leave. I got up from the chair, walked to the door, waited the guard to let me out. He got up and walked up behind me, and he said, if I need to show you something, how long would you take me to get you out of here? Get me out of here. And I said, it'd take me a couple of days. I'd have to get a writ to get him out of jail.
Walker said he notified TBI agents about what Terry had told him, but that no one went to meet with him over the next few days. And when he went to meet with Terry again much later, Terry didn't want to talk. On cross-examination, it was revealed that when Dykus had asked Walker to interview Terry Britt, Dykus had been told by his supervisor to stand down and to leave Terry Britt alone, something Walker said he was not aware of at the time. Walker also admitted to telling Terry Britt that he was looking at 30 years in prison for federal firearms violations at the time, and admitted to leaving many details from what he testified to out from his report. When prosecutor Jennifer Nichols asked why that was, Walker responded, I wasn't there to get testimonial evidence. A former bail bondsman took the stand and said that she bonded Zach out of jail on April 4th, after he was charged with drug charges and evading arrest. She said she noticed that he had scratches all over his arms, legs, and neck, like he ran through the woods, she said. Remember that Zach had told his girlfriend that that's where the scratches had come from. And then the defense called their own cell phone expert to the stand, Jonathan Reeves, a cell phone design expert who consults for wireless carriers, testified that Zach's phone and Holly's phone were not in the same place at the same time on the day that Holly was missing. He said that because there were so few call records, it was hard to determine anything definitive on Shane Austin's phone. Prosecutor Hagerman asked if Shane could have possibly had his phone turned off when he abducted Holly, and Reeves said correct. The final witness for the defense was James Garnett, a special agent with the TBI, who did an analysis on Terry Britt's computer in 2012. He testified that some of the search terms found on Terry's computer were abducted, rape scene, and kidnapped. Zach Adams chose not to testify. The prosecution called a couple witnesses to testify in their rebuttal case. One of them was a former TBI agent who said that Terry Dykus, the defense's star witness, had been thrown off the case in 2013 for a very specific reason. Quote, he had lost his objectivity about all of the facts coming into the case and had tunnel vision. The jury of six men and six women deliberated for 11 hours before finding Zach guilty of the kidnapping, rape, and murder of Holly Bobo. In a deal reached with the state, Zach will serve life in prison without the possibility of parole, plus 50 years, instead of the death penalty. Karen Bobo spoke to the court after Zach was sentenced. She said Holly was the sweetest soul she had ever known in her life, and said there's a piece of them that will always be missing. She said the night that Zach was found guilty, she saw her husband smile for the first time in 6.5 years. Dylan Adams has yet to go to trial for his alleged role in Holly's murder, and Jason Autry has yet to be sentenced for his. Both will be in court for status hearings in November. And that's all for this episode. A special thank you to the sponsors of today's show, including The Snowman. The Snowman, starring Michael Fassbender and Rebecca Ferguson, and directed by internationally acclaimed filmmaker Thomas Alfredson, comes to theaters October 20th. The Snowman. See it only in theaters October 20th. If you'd like to discuss this case or any others with me, consider joining my Facebook discussion group by going to courtjunkie.com/Facebook. You can also follow me on Twitter at courtjunkiepod or on Instagram at courtjunkie. Today's case was a listener's request, and if you have a case you'd like to hear on Court Junkie, please shoot me an email at podcast@courtjunkie.com. And if you'd like to support this podcast, you can donate as little as $1 a month by going to courtjunkie.com/support. This will redirect you to my Patreon page, where you can get early, ad-free access to all of my future episodes. You can also buy a Court Junkie t-shirt, sweatshirt, mug, or pretty much anything else you can possibly imagine having the Court Junkie logo on, by going to courtjunkie.com/store. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.